We've been seeing campaign signs in front lawns. We've gotten candidate mailers at our houses. But the 2018 voting season is about to start in earnest this coming Tuesday. It's an exciting moment for a lot of us, but especially first-time voters. And this time around, there's a lot of interest in what first-time voters are going to do because experts are predicting that a whole lot of them will be showing up at the polls. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we want to hear from voters planning to get out there and cast a ballot for the very first time. 816-235-2888 is the number to call, or you can tweet us. We are at KCUR-CST. Our guest this morning is Beth Vanami. She's a political science professor at UMKC, and her expertise is how voter psychology affects political outcomes. Hi, Beth.
Good morning.
So big picture, stepping back, is there a change in the air as people gear up to vote in 2018 from what you saw in 2016?
Absolutely. I think there's a passion that we haven't seen in the past. And, you know, part of that is probably the Trump administration and policies that affect different kinds of people than we saw in the past. So that's leading to a lot of momentum among different kinds of voters.
You work on a college campus in an urban environment in a political science department. What does that particular vantage point tell you about what we're considering a sizable block of first-time voters?
Well, it's actually a great location for me because what I've seen over the last 2 years especially is a huge increase in the number of students who want to take political science courses, want to find out more about the political process, and want to get involved in politics in some way, a real activism among young people, which is really exciting.
Can you tell me more about what that looks like?
Yeah, so we certainly, students in political science are always interested in politics, so that's not a surprise. But what we've seen is more of a motivation to become active, not just by voting, but protesting and contacting officials, getting out there, even donating to some extent, which for college students is a really big deal. So it's a really exciting time to be sort of watching the political process play out.
So for those first-time voters who are doing this for the first time because they're just finally old enough to vote, how do you think some of that energy you're seeing and just the character of that energy is going to translate into the voting booth?
Well, I think, you know, they have a chance to have a real effect this time around. With midterm elections, turnout is typically lower than presidential elections, usually by about 20 to 25%. So any sort of new group of voters, whether they're voting for the first time or just, you know, returning to the polls after a sort of an absence, they can have a real effect on the outcome. And so it's an exciting time for new voters and old voters.
I've done some reading on this, and the Rock the Vote organization is saying that millennials will constitute the largest voting bloc in 2018. If that's true, they're not just joining the voting party, they're totally changing the game, possibly.
Right. So if they turn out, and that's right. Really critical.
If that prediction is correct.
Right. So if millennials, the sort of those between the ages of 18 and 29, actually show up to vote, they could have a huge effect on the outcome. The problem in the past is that that particular age group has voted at sometimes half the rate of voters over the age of 40 and certainly over those over the age of 65. So if they show up, it could dramatically alter the outcome of elections.
So if they show up, how would you expect them to alter the outcome?
Well, so one thing that we've heard a lot about millennials and people, sort of young voters, is that they're really liberal. And I want to sort of do away with that misnomer, because the reality is that they fall pretty clearly along the same lines as older voters. The one big difference for younger voters is that they tend to be less likely to affiliate with a political party. So they tend to sort of be liberal, moderate, conservative, as the rest of voters are. But they're less likely to say, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, which has meant that candidates can really appeal to them across party lines.
And so as that individuals?
Have an effect. Yes, exactly. And so I think that can have an effect if a candidate wants to sort of really capitalize on that block of voters, appealing to things that matter to those voters.
from an issues standpoint, what do politicians kind of have to address in 2018 because of the particular concerns of young voters?
Well, there are two issues that I think are really inspiring young voters to show up at the polls and to get active, and that's gun violence and school shootings and immigration. And sort of the steps the Trump administration has taken on immigration has really inspired young voters to protest, to register to vote, and so forth. So I think those two issues have to really be addressed. Education is always an issue that young voters care about, but I would say the first two are most critical.
My first election was a presidential election. It was Clinton Dole, if you want to date me that way. But I'm curious whether first-time voters do tend to turn out in large numbers for local elections. You've said that the turnout in general is lower, but also like the momentum that gets someone who doesn't even yet have their foot in the door in some ways.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is the case that local elections and midterm elections have lower turnout overall, and it's much worse among new voters because they don't have that habit of participating. You tend to get sort of the people who always participate show up, especially in local elections. When you have just city council elections or mayoral elections, numbers can drop to the single digits, and that tends not to include new voters. So yeah, it's always going to be lower in midterm elections, but if there's enough passion there and candidates are inspiring enough, I think you'll see turnout at really record numbers this time around.
Do you think social media has the potential to change that? I've seen so many reminders on social media about like milestones, like the registration deadline approaching, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. So any mechanism that'll make voting either more convenient or less costly is certainly going to encourage people to vote. And another big change that I think new voters should take advantage of is that there's now online voter registration in both Kansas and Missouri. And so if your documents are accurate at the motor vehicle office, then you should be able to register online. And that's a huge time saver.
Call 816-235-2888 if you are a first-time voter, or if I guess you're going to be a first-time voter. What do you care about, and how do you think people like you are going to change things? 816-235-2888 is the number to call with your story. Beth, what about people who are first-time voters for reasons other than their age?
Sure. So there's three other different groups that I would say are become new voters. Those who are naturalized citizens, so they've just become U.S. citizens, so they're just eligible to vote. Individuals that have been incarcerated and are now completed their sentence and are now re-eligible to vote. And then individuals who've really been turned off by politics, but something, an issue, a candidate really inspires them. Again, during midterm elections, that tends not to be super common, but I think this time around, you're going to see people who are voting for the first time after years of really being turned off by the political process, who are inspired either pro or against the Trump administration.
So talk to me first about that last category, because if you're saying that this category of voter, the previously turned off from politics or just maybe even not invested in politics voter, you know, there has been a lot of messaging since the last presidential election about, you know what, the place to make a real difference is on the local level. Do you think that that messaging has been effective?
Well, I think it's certainly good to have that messaging. And, you know, it is absolutely true that, you know, you can have your greatest effect on the political process by participating locally. But national elections are also important, especially midterm elections. They, you know, establish the House and the Senate and who controls those. And I think to underestimate the effect one voter can have on policymaking is a mistake. And we want to make sure people show up at all kinds of elections.
So then talk to me about the recently naturalized U.S. citizens. You mentioned that immigration is an issue that is inspiring a lot of people to come to the polls and that is of particular interest to first-time voters who are really young. But I would think that immigration would be an issue dear to the hearts of people who have just been naturalized?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is not a question at all that individuals who are becoming citizens for the first time are going to be looking at sort of the policies of the administration and, you know, questioning whether they, you know, should be concerned about the policies. And so, sure, I would expect them to vote.
And people who have been incarcerated in the past and are voting for the first time because this is their first opportunity since release, what would you expect the issues that group of voters would be focusing on?
Well, the obvious would be sort of criminal justice issues and prison reform of that nature. But I suspect, like most voters, they're concerned about economic issues and sort of economic prospects and where the economy's headed and so forth.
With these different categories of first-time voters, are you concerned about obstacles that tend to keep any of these particular groups of people from the polls despite intentions to be first-time voters?
Oh, sure. I think the biggest obstacle, of course, is registration. And with Missouri and Kansas having different rules, it's important that people get registered in a timely manner. Even if you don't know that you want to vote, you can't vote if you don't register. So that's the biggest obstacle. And I hope people pay attention to those deadlines and get registered.
Let's talk to John in Kansas City, Missouri. John's calling us at 816-235-2888 to tell us about being a first-time voter. Hi, John. John, welcome to the show. Okay, we're not hearing John. We'll go back to the lines in just a moment. Is there such a thing as first-time voter psychology, as in like a state of mind that makes voters who haven't done this before behave in certain ways?
Well, I think there's different motivations that will drive people's behavior. But I think one thing that I, you know, when I was a first-time voter many, many years ago as well, you know, one thing that's really great about elections is sort of the excitement and the pageantry of Election Day. So I hope for first-time voters, they get to experience that and, you know, going to the polls, getting your I voted sticker and sort of being part of this democratic process with, you know, your closest 100 million friends is really an exciting time. So I hope they get to enjoy that experience.
The sticker is such a cool thing in a way. I feel like it's gotten to be like a badge of honor more and more in the time that I've been voting.
Oh, absolutely. And certainly, depending on your social networks, depends on how much of an honor badge that really is. But yeah, it can certainly inspire people to go vote themselves.
I'm going to go try to get back to one of our callers. Let's talk to John in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, John.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Tell me your story.
Well, I just recently became naturalized. I've never voted in a primary. Just a couple of local elections. My comment is just generally towards finding out more about the other candidates besides the front runners on the typical Democratic and Republican tickets. There's a few online databases where that information can be found as far as voting records or education, work credentials for the other candidates that you never really hear about. As a general rule, I don't feel like the media does a very good job of covering those other non-frontrunner candidates. And so anyway, that's my comment.
Don't go away, John. I want to ask you something. We're going to answer your question or address it at least. But I'm curious, what has inspired you to make this your first time? Did you say your first time voting in a local primary?
Correct. Well, be the first time that I vote for federal offices, and there's always a lot going on, not just recently due to the issues that are being discussed. There's always a lot of important things going on, and I don't feel like the people that are not front runners get enough attention and therefore really never make it into office. So that's kind of why I do what I can to find out as much as I can about the other people that end up on the ticket.
All right. Well, thanks, John. First of all, Beth, anything you want to respond to in terms of what is bringing John out to a primary for the first time, a local primary?
Yeah, well, we certainly, this time around, less so in Missouri, but certainly in Kansas, there are so many candidates on the ballot in both the Democrat and Republican primaries for House and then also for the gubernatorial election in Kansas. I think it's going to inspire a lot of voters to show up because they're so competitive this time around for the Democrats, especially, which is a change from the past. So, yeah, I think that can certainly inspire people to come out. With things like independent candidates, they're not on the primary ballot. So that should inspire more general election turnout.
Do you think so? John's issue with finding out more about the non-front runners as he's approaching the election, but I think it's even fair to say just finding out candidate information can be for people who aren't like, you know, the diehard political followers, that can be challenging.
It can be. Normally, what I would suggest for new voters if they want to find out information is to rely on their local newspaper, usually puts out a voter guide, and usually local radio or the local TV stations will do the same. And that's the way I would find out initial information. And then all of the candidates at this point for federal office have websites and Twitter accounts and Facebook pages, which is a great way to find out additional information.
Let's talk to Derek in Waldo. Hi, Derek.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very good. I just want to say I'm a first time voter here. I'm a construction worker. I know a bunch of people as well who are going to be first-time voters. For years, I've been very interested in politics my whole life, though. But I think Mark Maron once said I was running the country from my couch. That's kind of what I've been doing. Either way, I know this is NPR, and I hope you guys don't hate me. I love all NPR listeners my whole life. I will be voting to prevent the impeachment of Donald Trump in November, and I know tons of people. Young people voting for the first time who will be doing the same come November. And it's strange, the enthusiasm, because most of them don't even know anything about anything. They just like the guy.
So concerns about impeachment, probably one way or the other, an interest in the issue of impeachment, bringing people to the polls. But Derek, tell me more about, I mean, you're talking about that within the construction industry, that the desire to keep Donald Trump in office is motivating a lot of people, you know.
Oh yeah, they like him. Oh my gosh, a lot of them are to the point. You know, most Trump supporters. I do not like most Trump supporters. I'll be honest with you. They, whatever he's done, he's accomplished a lot because he's gotten them to just be like, I'm with Trump. That's it. So you know, I guess he accomplished that, but still, they're just in that mode of, yeah, that's who I'm going with no matter what. I love them. He connects with them more than, I guess, any other person I've ever seen.
And were you saying that that's what's motivating you, too?
That's what's motivating me, too. I am not like most Trump supporters, though. I'm kind of strange, have very strange reasons for why. Well, I think the impeachment would be a big win for Russia. I think that's what the whole game was to begin with. And
well, Derek,
and at worst, he's a moderate Republican. At worst, he's George Bush, honestly. I really think he is.
Getting back to this issue of being a first-time voter, you're saying that you've been running the country from your chair. I mean, it sounds like there is one reason that you're getting up off the chair. Is that right? Or is there something bigger that's changed you? Like, will you keep voting after this one?
I may, depending on how it goes. I don't know. I'm pretty, as most young people are, pretty unhappy with the way things have become, the way it's just kind of like a hegemony that's been set up by people that have nothing to do with us, and all these you know, it's just it seems to have nothing to do with us a lot of times, I guess, and until now. I don't know, once with China coming up, you know, they want to rule the world by 2025. I think it's really go time. America cannot be having any type of weakness. I mean, they want to control 70% of future manufacturing and future development by 2025. And they do it, too. I mean, they'll say, hey, you want
Derek,
a permit to build here? All right, give us your intellectual property, and then we'll give you the permit. I mean,
thank you so much. We're starting to get into territory that we're probably not going to be able to address in a conversation about first-time voters. But you have been running the country from your couch, and you're going to go vote now. Congratulations on joining voters.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Beth, what do you hear in this call?
Well, I think I'm glad Derek called, because it's a good point to make that not all young voters are, you know, liberal progressives who are going to beat the drum for the Democratic Party. Young voters, like all voters, you know, are split down party lines, ideological lines. And, you know, just as some young voters are going to be inspired against the Trump administration, there are plenty of young voters like Derek who are going to be motivated to show their support for Trump. And we see that a lot in midterm elections, where it's really a referendum on the president and whether or not people like him or her, if ever the case may be.
We are planning to follow first-time voters and their experiences throughout the whole 2018 election season. What do you want to know? What questions would you have if you were in my position?
I would want to know a little bit about new voters generally, about why they are interested this time around, because a midterm election is kind of a strange time to be sort of inspired. So I would, you know, it's easy to get inspired in a presidential election, but I'd like to see what about the midterm elections inspires them.
Well, we are going to be following first-time voters throughout this season, so tell us your story, and maybe we'll bring you on the air next time. You can email us, centralstandard@kcur.org, or tweet us at @KCURCST. Beth Venami, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, the alleys of Kansas City on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're zooming in on the alleys of Kansas City. A few exceptional alleys are coming to life, with what used to be hidden little nooks and crannies turning into storefronts, proving that alleys can be charming little pedestrian paths if you choose to treat them that way. But historically, that's not how American cities have thought about alleys. Here to talk with me about that is Lynn Freehill May. She's written extensively about urban sustainability and design for the Atlantic City Lab, the New York Times, and other publications, and she's got a soft spot for alleys. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
What made you start thinking really in a focused way about alleys in American cities? What interests you about them?
Well, I write, as you mentioned, I write about place, what makes places distinct and livable and sustainable in the 21st century. That often encompasses travel, which takes me to different places to explore what makes them special. And a couple years ago on a bike tour of Montreal, which not in the States, but in North America, I realized that alleys kind of take you backstage. I had a great tour guide who really took me around some of Montreal's 250 green alleyways. And I realized here I was getting a glimpse of everyday, local, more hidden life, and that the possibilities were huge here. These spaces were community connectors and also green spaces. They were the kind of places where I was invited into a garden or in for a glass of wine in the backyard, and neighbors were having trick-or-treating, block parties, or pop-up restaurants, really interesting things going on. So I wrote about that for the New York Times because I realized it was exactly the kind of experience intrepid travelers were looking for. And in my research, I started to come across a lot of American cities doing interesting things as well.
You know, I want you to sort of flesh out a comment you just made. Alleys take you backstage.
Yeah. So it's interesting. They were really designed in the U.S. as these sort of backstage spaces. That's where horses and carriages went. Pardon me. That's where garbage pickup was done. There were sort of improvised living areas back there, especially for immigrants and for newly freed slaves after the Civil War. But they were like public, you know, semi-private public spaces, you know, not the street front that was designed for public consumption. So interesting things would go on back there.
What is the difference between how American cities have used alleys historically and how cities in Europe and other places maybe have been doing it for a long, long time?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, in other places in the world that have longer histories than the U.S. Of at least sort of developed urban spaces, different interesting things have gone on. In Europe, that you have a lot of medieval kind of warrens going back to basically the Middle Ages, really narrow alleys, for instance, in Stockholm, that are only like maybe 3 feet wide. kind of market spaces in places like Istanbul. In China, you've got the hutongs in Beijing, which are sort of mysterious walled alleyways that go back centuries. Then even in Australia, like in the city of Melbourne, there are they're known for their laneways, which were sort of cart delivery routes. And now they're some of the liveliest bar and restaurant scenes in the cities, their laneways. So different places, there's a history of alleys in different, all kinds of different countries and all around the world, but used very differently than in the U.S.
You know, in American vernacular, like if we're talking to each other and someone says, they turn down a dark alley, you know, that's a setup for something bad's going to happen. It's shorthand for a sketchy, dangerous situation. But why do we equate alleys with darkness and danger in the U.S. when what you've just described all over the rest of the world is a very different picture?
Well, they were sort of not exactly vacated. Vacated is a technical term where some cities do give up their public right to the alley as a public space.
And that actually does happen a lot in Kansas City, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, I've heard that. So I don't want to say vacated, but they were disused. So after World War II, before like World War I, we were purposefully laying them out, you know, alleys as these backstage spaces in the U.S. But after World War II, we wanted our like big boat-like affluential token cars parked out front. And by the 1960s, the American Planning Association considered alleys obsolete, or American planners, should I say. And so, yeah, they were
Because we liked this front-facing display of what we were doing? Is that's really why?
Well, we like to show off, and so we weren't using those back spaces anymore. We weren't using the horses and carriages. And when you aren't using a space as much, that is when you know, crime can happen and things like that. And so they got this sort of edge of danger kind of reputation.
So according to this recent article in CityLab, there's kind of a nationwide trend right now to open up the alleys and bring them to life. Can you give me some examples of how that looks in different places?
Oh, yeah. There are so many interesting things going on in so many cities, including Kansas City. But at the time I started my research, I wasn't aware of Kansas City. So some of the things that popped out to me right away were in Seattle. They've designated some alleys as festival streets where they can hold events. They'll have movie screenings, block parties, concerts, etc. In Chinatown in San Francisco, they're doing neighborhood tours. They realize that people love these pedestrian kind of spaces, and so they'll do purposeful alley tours, kind of like I did in Montreal. In the design district in Miami, which is a very ultra high-end retail district, there are a couple notable alleys by a designer, Daniel Toul, that are really interesting and I think show some of the potential of redesigned alleys, and obviously for retail in that case. Then in Nashville, I was just there, and they're doing a lot of rain gardens to mitigate flooding there. But then there are also other interesting things that are like there's Printer's Alley, which is a notable nightlife strip and has been for decades. And that's often a really good fit for alleys, you know, with that edge of danger reputation, you know, a speakeasy, a nightclub. Those are really great fits and a really fun place to go out.
So capitalizing on that reputation of the alley.
Yeah,
in that last
yeah.
case. Why is this happening now, this larger trend of reviving the alley?
Well, it's really interesting. A few scholars saw this coming. There was an academic named Grady Clay. He was out of Louisville. He wrote a book in the late 70s, early 80s called Alleys, a Hidden Resource. And he predicted that as cities densified, that we'd become more interested in these spaces. A landscape architect at Iowa State, Michael Martin, did several studies in the 90s and early 2000s hold and kind of saw the same thing, that we could make alleys into community connectors as we densified our cities. Now, you know, as we are here in, you know, 2015, 2016, 2017, and now hitting up against a couple trends where it all comes together, I think that is true. Our cities are densifying, as these guys predicted, but also millennials really want walkability and community. And most of all, probably there's a big emphasis societally now on sustainability. And so cities like Chicago and Nashville, which I mentioned, realize that you can mitigate climate change effects like flooding with more absorbent alleyways.
So this all sounds great, but Are there problems that kind of pop up when alleys that have been used primarily to stash dumpsters or for unloading and loading delivery trucks become more active in other ways?
Oh, yeah. It's very complex. I think one of the greatest areas of complexity, and some of your guests in Kansas City might speak to this, are expense. It's really expensive to redo an alleyway. So you've got cities like Chicago that are like, let's spend on it. No problem. This is worth doing. It costs a lot, but they'll put down more permeable pavement and flood control, you know, as a first step, seeing climate change coming. But it's, you know, ownership can be complex. Yeah, the shared use. Okay, if you want retail use and you want pedestrians and you want it lively, but you also need garbage to come down, that can be complex. Sometimes just the ownership. Okay, who's going to plow the snow here in the more northern cities? It's a lot to hammer out. You can't just as a neighborhood always say, okay, we want to make our alley better. Let's do it. You find there is a lot of red tape and planning and expense that you have to go through.
Well, hang on with me. Thomas Moorfield is with us now. He's the director of community planning for Bike Walk KC, and he's written a 5-part blog series putting a spotlight on what he considers the best alleys in Kansas City. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning.
So why did you write this blog series?
So I think my interest in alleys in Kansas City came out of a process where the city was considering vacating an alley, basically saying that this no longer needs to be a public space. We're going to give it back to the adjacent property owners because it's a maintenance burden or it's a liability and it doesn't serve a public purpose today. And so we don't need it. And that led me to explore a little bit more. What are the values of these spaces and what might they be useful for?
So would you say that Kansas City has been part of this national trend of reviving the alleyway, integrating them into the fabric of the city?
I think there's some really good examples in Kansas City of alleys doing more than they used to. There's several examples in the Crossroads and downtown and other urban core neighborhoods where people are landscaping alleys, opening businesses in alleys, looking at them as not just for their functional role, which is very important in terms of, you know, keeping utilities and deliveries out of the street and but also as public spaces and public connectors as part of a broader sort of transportation network in the city.
So let's zoom in on a couple of specific places. Your number one pick for best alleys in Kansas City, that was the Commons. Where is the Commons? Where is the Commons?
Okay,
talk to me about some of your favorite alleys in Kansas City.
All right. Sorry, Gina. So, I think the best alleys are those that work as, quality public spaces, but also work well as in terms of their functional role, as I said, and allowing the services of the city to function. And if you've ever been stuck behind a delivery truck on the street or walked around a utility box, you understand why that's important. One of my favorite alleys is in the Crossroads near 18th Street in Wyandotte, where there's lots of good things going on, and it's sort of an intimate space. I think any alley that sort of provides a respite from the busy city is important. So you have big streets, big buildings, big spaces, big noises, and the alley is an experience that you don't get in other parts of the city. And so the alleys that provide that unique respite or that unique opportunity, that solitude and intimacy, those are the ones that work best.
So you write about a lot of alleys off of Southwest Boulevard.
Yeah, there's a lot of these alleys that are most interesting are those where the street grid gets complicated. Those are the moments where
What do you mean by that? The street grid gets complicated.
The grid of the street. So streets don't exactly line up, and there's these little pockets of spaces and these little moments in the city where you don't know what exactly is around the next corner, or there's a little opening or a little passageway that's interesting, that's not just the normal grid of the city. And then those are, you know, if you think of places people really enjoy, or if someone, you know, travels to Europe and says, I went to this amazing medieval city, and what did it feel like? What sort of spaces do they want to go to? What sort of spaces do they want to spend time in? It's these unique little moments, these intimate spaces, these unexpected experiences on the street that add to a person's enjoyment of the city and experience of the city.
What about Bank Street? I love this one. I saw the pictures on your blog post, and I'm pretty sure your blog is the first time I've really thought about this particular little artery kind of off of around maybe like 11th Street. But you can see the Missouri River from here. I love the photos. Tell me more about this spot. So, yeah, just tell me more about some alleys in downtown Kansas City.
As I said, these moments where you can either connect between spaces in unexpected ways, or you can incorporate a lot of the downtown alleys, Art in the Loop does a lot of work with art projects incorporated into the alley projects. There's an opportunity here to enhance the experience and also to add value to the surrounding areas. Every alley has its own personality. So some are these quaint little moments, some are these connectors that lead you from place to place, and all of them add a little bit something different to your experience of the city.
Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about the alley in your part of town that's got a life of its own, or a view that you love, or just a story to tell. 816-235-2888. We're going to hear about some cool things happening in Kansas City's alleys in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back, and we're talking about alleys on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Thomas Moorfield. He wrote a 5-part blog series on alleys in Kansas City. Hi again, Thomas.
Hello.
And we have also been talking with Lynn Freehill May. She's a freelance writer who writes a lot about alleys, knows a lot about their history, and we'll be bringing her back in too. Call 816-235-2888 if there's an alley you think is interesting. And now I want to bring in some people who are doing things in alleys here in town. Diocelyn Tott, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, good, good.
So Diocelyn is a 24-year-old community organizer who's been part of something called the Art Squad. And Diocelyn, tell me about what the Art Squad has been doing in the alleys of Kansas City, Kansas.
Okay, so the Art Squad, we made it about 7 years ago, as a matter of fact. We were all around 14, 16 years old at that time. And we decided to do a project to revitalize our community. We had been doing different programs under our community's building and engagement department. So we were able to come up with our own idea, and we decided to draw murals on alleys.
So you're saying you wanted to revitalize your neighborhood, but take me into what that looked like. I mean, what was it that needed revitalizing? What was going on?
So a lot of the things that we noticed in our community was the sidewalks. We know that some of them were non-existent at points. There was a sidewalk at a certain point, but not anymore because of the overgrown debris. Or there was broken sidewalks. So a lot of the times we saw kids walking from school on the streets or on the alleyways. The alleyways, however, we saw a lot of graffiti with negative words, different things that, you know, were promoting negative kind of pathways. So knowing that we didn't have that essential sidewalk that was accessible by everybody, and knowing that a lot of people use the alleyways, we wanted to go in, clean the alleyways, and instead of having a negative message, we wanted to create something different. We wanted to create more positive. Instead of seeing negative words, see something artistic, color, something that would be more hopeful than negative.
So how did you go about doing this? How did you go from having the idea to making it happen?
So our mentor, Steve Curtis, was actually our leader at that moment, and he decided to sit us down at a table, asked us what was a community issue that we saw in our neighborhood. He told us if we could come up with a project, we would be able to try it out and see if it could be worthwhile. And we decided that we were going to draw murals on alleyways. It took us a while. It was not a fast process to think about. But once we had it, our rule was to get four houses in the neighborhood. At first, it was a little bit weird, you know, 14 years old, going into the house, knocking on doors saying, hey, can we paint a free mural on your backyard at no cost? We're going to do all these different things. Not a lot of people were welcoming at the moment. They weren't rude, but it was weird. We did understand that. So we were able to get three houses. And then we realized that Steve, our leader, had a house in the neighborhood. So we were just like, hey, can we do your house as well? With that, we completed the four. We started the first year. It was just regular murals, trying to get different artwork out there. And after the first year, our demand went up. People really liked what we were doing. They wanted to be a part of the project. And sometimes, unfortunately, there was such a huge demand that we weren't able to keep up because we didn't have the manpower for it. But the community actually started doing their own murals as well.
That's so cool. How do you think the murals changed people's experiences of the places that they lived and worked and went to school? I mean, what were you hearing from people about why they were so enthusiastic?
There were just a lot of the comments were just the fact that it was something different. It was colorful. There was no more tagging. There was no more, you know, having to paint over and over and over again. Because the first 2 years, we did have some tags. Some of the murals get tagged, and we were able to come back and repaint them. But after the 2 years, they haven't been touched ever since. And because of that, I feel like the community just kind of came together. They decided that they were going to be a part of this. That they wanted to create their own artistic, you know, murals, and that they wanted to share this with different people. So they started walking the alleys. They started bringing their kids in the alleys.
This brings up to me, I mean, when I listen to you talking, what I think about is that alleys are these things that if you're not from the neighborhood, if you don't have a reason to be there a lot, if you're just driving through in your car, these are not spaces you're going to pay a lot of attention to, but that they matter to the people who are there.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
Let's talk to Chris. Let's talk to Koki. Koki Reardon is calling us, and we're talking to her from a jewelry store in the Crossroads, the one you can only get to from the alley. Hi, Koki.
Hi.
So tell me the story of how you ended up moving onto this alley off of West 18th Street.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. For me, it was a bit of a natural fit. I live in the adjacent Westside neighborhood, and I had a studio as a jewelry artist. I had a studio in that building since 2005. But when the owners of the Bower, who've been in the area for a long time, decided to redo the building, they had this concept of, you know, potentially having alley shops. And so it was kind of the perfect time for them to lay down those plans, and that was in 2011. So I immediately, you know, was interested and, you know, requested a space and got the space. And, you know, actually wasn't intending to have a retail shop. I went from a studio artist to being a retail owner. But it was really super interesting because it's created this very creative environment. I lived in Paris for many years, for the majority of the 90s, where I learned to do jewelry making. And this idea of alleyway, passageway, reminds me of the Paris passageways, you know, and there's all these cute shops, and there's just this very pedestrian environment, and it was just very appealing. So that's kind of how I got into it, and, you know, and we're continuing to try to expand it. There's lots of things happening even on either side of our alley.
Before you get to the things that are going to happen, just in terms of what's happened so far, I mean, what have there been challenges?
Sure. First of all, to let people know that we're there. So we've done things like put lights up and, you know, put potted plants outside and made it so that people can, you know, maybe see if they peek down the alley, they see, hey, there's something down there. So we've been doing that, and you know, it's bringing more and more people. I mean, this is a great opportunity to let people know that we're there. So yeah, and you know, we're trying to get people from the streetcar to come over, you know, as opposed to just to staying on Main. You know, hey, come east and west. There are businesses on either side of Main that are interesting if you just take a quick walk.
I want to jump in and ask you about the appeal of an alleyway for a business owner. I mean, as space in a neighborhood like the Crossroads is at more and more of a premium, every little opportunity to move in somewhere, it seems to me, is just taking on a new kind of value. Would you have been able to open a place right in the heart of things in the Crossroads if not in the alley?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I mean, I guess I have to give credit to the owners of our building, the Bauer building. I mean, the owners are part of the Crossroads Community Organization, and they've kept it very affordable for artist-based businesses to be in the Crossroads. We've been down there, like I said, since, gosh, before 2005, before I even got there. But they've kept it affordable, and that's, you know, that's credit to them for allowing us to create this, you know, small creative businesses in this community. And I really feel like we're driving, you know, very interesting environment for other people to come down and see. You know, every shop is very individual. It's all, you know, everyone has their own intuition and creative abilities, and it's really creating a really interesting space for everyone.
You know, so you mentioned that some things are happening and going to happen in the Crossroads and the alleys, and our guest Thomas knows a lot about that. I'm curious, from your vantage point, you know, what were you thinking about?
Well, I know that, you know, we're just trying to make sure people know that we're there for Coqui Bijou, so my business. And, yeah, I noticed that Thomas had a picture of our alley on his blog, so that's wonderful. But I do know that the building owners to the north and south of us are also interested in doing things. So we're at the 18th Street alley between Baltimore and Wyandotte. Just north of us, the building owners are going to start doing alley shops. And then south of us, they're working on a sculpture alley. So they've got a handful of artists that I think are going to be rotating, where there's just outdoor sculpture in that alley.
Very cool. Thomas, yeah. Moorfield, tell us more about what's happening with alleys in Kansas City.
Sure. So there's two interesting things coming up in the near term. One is a mural project. So as I understand, more than 30 local and international artists will be painting September 14th, 15th, and 16th in the Crossroads, a series of murals in alleys, and also, as was mentioned, a sculpture alley. So that's along Southwest Boulevard between 19th Terrace, between Southwest Boulevard, 19th Terrace, Baltimore, and Wyandotte. And there, two Kansas City Art Institute students have been selected to design and build pieces, and I understand from Crossroads representatives that they expect those to be installed before the fall. So I think there's a growing recognition of the potential of these spaces to be, you know, to encourage arts and business and other activity.
Lynn Freehill May, I want to bring you back in on this. We haven't spoken with you in a while, but you've been hearing so much about what's going on in Kansas City, and I'm curious, you know, is there something in this conversation about what's happening here in Kansas City that you think it's really important to put, like, an exclamation point next to?
Oh, it really struck me with everything that Thomas and Dioselin and Koki are saying, that Kansas City fits right into, you know, the national trend really well and is doing some really interesting things. I mean, when you talk about murals, that's one of the things. So how do you invite people down an alley? How do you tell them this is a welcoming space? This is not a dangerous space or a derelict space anymore. One of the things, often you see lights strung above the alley. You see landscaping. And often that's like really purposeful landscaping that serves a rain garden function too, seating, and then murals, which is exactly what Dioselin was talking about, or it's sculpture alley. I mean, that is something I have not heard of elsewhere and seems really exciting. So everything I hear, I think, wow, this fits in really well, but is distinct to Kansas City too. And that's really cool to see different cities reimagining in different distinct ways how their alleys might function.
Diasel and Todd, I mean, we'll just go out talking with you about what you see the future of murals and alleyways in KCK being. Do you see a future for this taking a new direction, a new life?
Oh, definitely. I am really excited to hear what's going down the crossroads. I want to go down myself, as a matter of fact, now. But, you know, I'm really excited that these are coming. I'm thrilled to see where it's going. And, you know, I really like the fact that the murals are going because we're sharing stories. We're bringing pride into it of different cultures, diversity. And it's just cool to see how many different things we can connect with, relate to, and then see how hopeful we are to grow.
Will you just describe one mural, one of your favorites?
I think one of our favorite ones is the Mario mural. We have a Mario mural on 11th in around Split Log and Ella. And it was a recycling initiative that we did with the student council in elementary school. And they were doing a recycling initiative, was able to fundraise a lot of money to get 100 recycling bins and give out to their community. And now they have a presentation of Mario with a recycling spin to it.
Cool. Well, Diasel and Tot, thank you so much for joining us from UrbanWorks in KCK.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And thanks also to Cokie Reardon of Bijou Fine Jewelry, Thomas Moorfield of Bike Walk KC. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Lynn, thank you.
Thank you so much, Gina.
If you didn't catch this whole discussion about alleys in Kansas City, you can grab it at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we will revisit our conversation about the life of artist Wendell Castle. Today's show was produced by Suzanne Hogan and Coy Duggar. With help from intern Trevor Hook, thanks to Melody Rowell and Sylvia Maria Gross, I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.